Hello, is this the Rubber Ducky Rainbow Preschool? Great. Well, I'm calling about the rejection letter that I just got saying you won't allow me to perform Tusk and Beak, my musical puppet show about an elephant and a snowy owl. Well, how could it be too controversial? Oh, you mean the references to homosexuality, cross-dressing, unprotected sex, AIDS, sadomasochism, drugs, and anarchy? You're counting those as controversial? Yeah, but these kids are living with these realities. Don't you understand that? Well, maybe they should spend a little less time thinking about blocks and juice and puzzles, and maybe a little more time getting real. You think the trial scene is over their heads? But that's the fulcrum of the show. It reveals the corrupt system these animals are living in. The kids are totally going to get it. I mean, they've all seen Inherit the Wind, right? None of them have. Okay, that's a bad assumption on my part. All right, well, what if I made some changes? What if the elephant wasn't gunned down in the last scene? What is it with you people? This is the same backward, overprotective attitude I've encountered in the other 57 preschools I approached. You people are sucking the life out of theater. Today on our Tuesday Tumble, we'll be talking about Trumbull's tussle over the musical Rent, about threats to snowy owls and elephants, and about the case of Eddie Perez. And now his opera based on Reservoir Dogs has been banned from all Montessori schools. Colin McEnroe.
That's right. It's Tuesday. I've been away for a few days. We're going to use our Monday format here on Tuesday, which is when we sort of come in the morning, figure out what the show is going to be, do it on deadline, sometimes let the news of the day dictate that. We'll tell you probably the biggest news story that we'll be analyzing here in the first segment in just a second. But looking down the road at the rest of the show, let me quickly tell you, we will be telling you about what's happened at Trumbull High School, where a student production of Rent, the school version of Rent, has been canceled by the principal. And although there are negotiations going on, perhaps even right now, to salvage this. It's kind of turned into a bigger story than I think Trumbull would have expected, kind of a national story. And they're doing what they can to salvage this situation. Also, snowy owls are here in the Northeast in more profusion than ever before and in places that they are not ordinarily seen. This is wonderful news for birders, except that in New York, the Port Authority is very worried about bird strikes and actually put out a kill order on this fairly rare bird. We'll tell you how that's getting resolved as well. Towards the end of the show, in a kind of a related story, I want to just tell you a story from the past. And so nature and science writer Richard Conniff is going to talk about the thriving ivory trade in Connecticut in the late 19th and early 20th centuries and how ultimately we got over our own addiction to elephant-based ivory. But we're going to begin with a very different kind of story, and that is the story of former Hartford Mayor Eddie Perez. He got, I guess, good news from an appellate court yesterday. It was decided that to vacate his previous verdict, that he will get to two different trials. Now, he was charged with, and this all happened in 2010, based on incidents that happened, I think, around 2006. He was charged with two different things, one bribery, basically, one extortion, basically. The cases were combined. The appellate court yesterday decided that they shouldn't have been combined. And from here, the story will probably get even more complicated. But joining us right now to explain it all, attorney Stephen Seligman. He's an attorney based in Hartford and often helps us out with these things. We're pleased to have him here in studio. So I did my fumbling best to describe what happened yesterday, but I'm sure you can do a much better job kind of setting the stage. What did the appellate court decide yesterday?
The appellate court decided what you said it decided, that it said that Mr. Perez, who was the subject of two separate unrelated charges. One had to do with his receiving of bathroom fixtures, what we know to be the white collar leitmotif among government officials.
Kitchen remodeling.
It's either cabinets or hot tubs or toilets and sinks. It was receiving those kinds of favors from a guy named Carlos Costa and then lying about it, allegedly fabricating evidence about it. And then wholly unrelated to that, Mr. Perez was accused of trying to extort money in behalf of the now dear departed Abe Giles relating to the so-called But Ugly building in Hartford. One issue in every criminal case is whether people who are accused of separate crimes should have the cases joined for trial, whether somebody's accused of one murder should also be accused in the same trial of one unrelated kidnapping. And the judge in this case granted the state's motion over the defendant's objection that the cases, the bribery and the extortion, which are separate fact patterns, be consolidated for trial, even though they were separate trials within the trial. The appellate court yesterday rendered a decision vacating former Mayor Perez's conviction, saying that it was fundamentally unfair. It was prejudicial, unduly prejudicial, to Eddie Perez to make him stand trial for these two sets of unrelated charges in the same trial. And though the appellate court said as to each count or each group of charges, there was sufficient evidence to justify his conviction, the joinder of the trying of these cases simultaneously, or at least consecutively, but before the same jury, deprived him of a fundamentally fair trial. And so the relief granted was what's called a vacating of the convictions and a remand or sending back to the trial court for now not one but two trials, because the bottom line is it's not fair to try these two sets of charges together.
Now, he was represented by, and ably, I think, represented by Attorney Hubert Santos. He's having a really good month. He's got a new trial for Michael Skakel, and now he's got two new trials for Eddie Perez.
If other than Peyton Manning or the Boston Red Sox, I don't know of anybody who's had a better year than Hubert J. Santos, and he deserves it.
And interestingly, in the Skakel case, the presiding judge in the Skakel case was one of the three judges, three appellate judges in the decision about Perez yesterday.
The appellate panel was comprised of the Chief Judge DePentima, Judge Douglas Levine, and Judge Tom Bishop, who has since retired from the appellate court and was sitting as a senior judge on the Skakel case. So Mr. Santos and Judge Bishop are BFF, or certainly Judge Bishop, he said jokingly because he wouldn't do this, is on Attorney Santos's Christmas card list. You know, and Michael Skakel's and Eddie Perez's.
One of the things Hubie Santos is kind of famous for doing is, you know, really kind of playing a pretty elaborate chess game with motions and continuances. And I mean, he's really, really famously good at this. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to hazard a guess. One of the things that happened in the trial was that Eddie Perez said that he would be willing to testify on his own behalf about one of the two cases, the bribery case, but he didn't want to testify. He would want to invoke the Fifth on the extortion case. Looking back at that, do you think that Hubert Santos saw this day coming? That seemed, reading the decision by the appellate court, that seemed to be germane, that seemed to be helpful, the fact that he was put in this odd position, at least in terms of, you know, his stated willingness to testify about one thing but take the Fifth about the other. That kind of, once again, emphasized the oddness of being on trial for two different cases.
When people complain about loopholes or somebody who's a bad guy getting out from under it because of some pinheaded appellate court ruling, I hasten to point out that appellate courts rarely reverse criminal convictions, number one. And number two, in order to get relief on appeal, somebody like Mr. Perez doesn't really have to show that the court made an error, but that the error was harmful. The bane of every criminal defense lawyer's existence is a doctrine called the harmless error doctrine, where the appellate or Supreme Court says it was a mistake, but the defendant appellant has shown insufficient prejudice or actual injury resulting from this mistake. In the Perez case, Hubert Santos and his then colleague, now Judge Hope Seeley, went to great pains meticulously to lay out at the time not merely some sort of abstract injury that Perez would suffer by having these two sets of charges joined, but really it is practical matter what they were. And one of them, one example of actual prejudice was, I would like to testify as to set of charges A, but I don't want to testify as to set of charges B. And if these were separate trials, my choice either to testify or not testify would be unremarkable, would not be conspicuous. But if I take the stand and try to explain away certain statements I made to an investigator on the bribery case, but don't talk at all about the extortion case, I'm invoking my right against self-incrimination, which is normally not something of which the jury should be made aware. So this was not idle speculation by the Santos-Seeley team back then, and it was incumbent upon them then, as well as before the appellate court, to make a showing of actual prejudice, and they succeeded in doing that, and that's the responsibility of a lawyer to what's called make a record, to say to a judge, Your Honor, not only are you making a mistake, respectfully, but this mistake has significant real-world present repercussions. And they did that, because if they had failed to make that showing, it would have been harmless error, convictions affirmed.
Now, as of yesterday, the state has said they're going to do something. Now, they're either going to appeal to an even higher court, the ruling issued by the appellate court yesterday, or they're just going to go ahead with these two new trials. Sort of game this out a little bit for us. First of all, how long a process could this conceivably be?
Because Perez was convicted, of course, he had a right of appeal. Because these were not the most serious crimes, his right of appeal was to our intermediate appellate court, which is called simply the appellate court. Mm-hmm. Don't ask me why. Not a good name. Now he has prevailed. So the state has a right to seek review by the Connecticut Supreme Court. But it's not an appeal as a matter of right. So it would have to petition for what's called a writ of certification. Whether or not the Connecticut Supreme Court would grant the writ, the petition, is subject to its discretion. So the state's options are either A, within 20 days of this decision being officially announced, which is not until next week, another odd concept we have here, but within the next 3 or 4 weeks to petition for certification to the Connecticut Supreme Court, or do nothing, in which case the ruling of the appellate court becomes final and the case is remanded, sent back to the trial court, to 101 Lafayette Street in Hartford, for now to get calendared as two separate trials. Which way the state will go, I don't know. Either way, uncertainty typically is what breeds resolution of cases. So the state's attorney can say to Perez's lawyer, okay, you've won this round. You've not won the war. You can run, but you can't hide. Santos can say, well, we're going to learn something from these first trials. We're going to win it the next time around. Who knows really what the last offer was on the part of the prosecution back several years ago when the case was tried. Mm-hmm. My prediction is that this case, whether it goes up on appeal or not, now the time is ripe for there to be a plea bargain. Whatever Eddie Perez is now, he's that many years removed from office. I don't envy a guy who's been going to bed for the last 3 years, having heard the trial judge say you're going to prison for 3 years. He certainly had the right to take this appeal, but he suffered by the pendency of these charges in this appeal. And the state, on the other hand, the case has been tried and a jury has accepted these witnesses. Both of the government's witnesses on each of these sets of charges were of some questionable credibility. The jury believed them and didn't believe the defense's explanation. So I think everybody gets educated, and the overwhelming likelihood is there will be some kind of plea bargain or resolution.
Because, in fact, I mean, just to sort of put it in a hypothetical terms, but probably not all that hypothetical, if, in fact, the first time around the state's attorney said, I won't accept a plea bargain that doesn't include prison time, that was then, this is now. Now he's been through an entire trial. He's facing two more trials. He's gotten a decision that was unfavorable to him from the appellate court. He might be in a different frame of mind. He might not be so absolutist about that.
That he could be either the state's attorney or Mr. Perez. Mm. You never know. I don't know from the outside looking in what the best offer was and why the case didn't resolve by a plea bargain. But now the circumstances are changed. Both sides have learned something about the quality of their cases. Mm-hmm. And if you're Mr. Perez, you got to say, it went bad for me. It went poorly for me once before. Now, on the other hand, you say, but it went poorly for me because I was in this unduly prejudicial situation. And if I have separate trials, maybe I'm going to do better. But I think a case settled is a case won.
All right. So thank you, Attorney Stephen Seligman. It has been a good year for Hubert Santos. If he could get a posthumous pardon for Jack Ruby by New Year's, I'd say that's pretty much the trifecta.
I would expect nothing less at this point.
Stephen Seligman, thanks very much for joining us.
Get a lawyer. for some help. When you're sitting in the courtroom, pay attention to the judge. Sua sponte means he did something on his own without a nudge. You don't like what is happening, be cool and do not vent. Act a fool, you're off to jail. That is called contempt. May it please the court. May it please the court. My argument is ready. May it please the court.
525,600 minutes. 525,000 moments, oh dear. 525,600 minutes. How do you measure a year? In daylights, in sunsets, in midnights.
It may seem like that long since the Trumbull Thespian Society got the news their planned production of the musical Rent by Jonathan Larson, you're just hearing a song from it right there, probably the most famous song from it, had been canceled by the principal of the Trumbull High School that they attend. Joining us right now is Larissa Marks. She's a student there, a president of the Trumbull High School Thespian Society, and someone who's done a pretty remarkable job in terms of calling attention to this problem, using social media and the press to get the story out and to make this into a pretty interesting conversation about these kinds of plays and their place in a high school theater setting. So, Larissa Marks, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
So, I know that there's been quite a bit of back and forth between you and the principal and between a bunch of other stakeholders. The first selectman of Trumbull's gotten involved as well. Before we get to sort of where things are right now, for people who haven't followed the story all that carefully, what did the principal of Trumbull High School tell you about the reason for canceling the planned production of Rent?
So in late November, we were supposed to have an informational meeting about auditions, which were going to happen in 2 weeks. However, instead, we had a thespian meeting with our principal, Mr. Greeno, where he told us that we would not be allowed to put on the musical because it has too many sensitive issues in it.
And the sensitive issues are homosexuality, sex, unprotected sex, AIDS, drug use. Those are the kinds of things. And I know that you're planning to do what's called the school edition. I don't know how tamed that is. I mean, I know the original production of Rent. I don't know how different the so-called school edition is.
So the school edition tones down a lot of the language in the show, as well as omitting some of the drug references. However, most of the storyline is kept intact.
And so, Larissa, what have you said back? What argument have you mustered on behalf of doing this show?
So our campaign to try and bring Rent to Trumbull has basically been to show that there is support from the community for this show and that the students at Trumbull High, as well as the residents in Trumbull, don't necessarily feel like the show has too many sensitive issues or is too controversial to put on in our theater.
Yeah, this has actually come up in other parts of the country, and not just with this show. It's the Laramie Project has been through similar kinds of challenges in high school. Now, there's been some back and forth on this. One of the suggestions that was made by the powers that be was maybe instead of doing it in the high school, it could be done in a kind of comparable summer youth theater. That didn't work out. That's not a possibility. We're going to talk in just a second to somebody from the Goodspeed who's offered you guys a chance to do it there. But it seems to me that the thing that you're talking about right now to the principal and perhaps also involving the first selectman as well is the idea of continuing somehow with the plan to do this in the school, but maybe within kind of a framework or matrix of other kinds of education that would go along with the show, education about some of the issues that come up in the show. Do I have this right?
So from what I've gathered from conversations I have had with the administration, different people, is that the school hopes to fully utilize this show as an educational experience, and there's been talk of creating a plan to better inform students about the issues in Rent and its messages.
And
the details of this plan aren't worked out yet.
They're not worked out. I mean, how close are you to, I mean, are you pretty confident at this point that the show will be done at Trumbull High School by the Thespian Society in the 2014 academic calendar?
Well, the pendulum seems to have swung towards our side in the last 24 hours. And I don't necessarily want to be overconfident since there are still a lot of details to be worked out. But I am hopeful that through the administration and us and the Thespian Society can work together and come to a conclusion soon.
You know, one thing I have to say, you seem like you seem a lot more level-headed than I was when I was in high school. And one of the things that you seem to have done, too, is to keep this from really boiling over into a confrontational issue. You somehow or other, you seem to have been able to stay in a conversation with your principal that is a conversation as opposed to a confrontation.
Well, I think that's two-sided. I mean, I have nothing against our principal. I think that he is a very nice man, and I am very glad to be working with him. And our dialogue has gone two ways, where I have been able to meet with him. He's been meeting with teachers and other students, and we have all been discussing. So this isn't necessarily a confrontation because both sides don't want it to be. We're working towards a dialogue where we can come to the best conclusion.
Did the dialogue that you're having make you think more about the importance of doing a play like Rent, about the having the freedom to do a play like Rent, about the role that a play like Rent can have in, you know, whether or not anybody sets up a whole curriculum to go with it, even if that doesn't happen, the role that a play like Rent can have in getting people to think and talk about the issues that are in the script?
I think that this has definitely been an opportunity for many people to look closer at Rent the Musical and its messages. I mean, if you look at the script and the storyline, the entire show is about love and acceptance and how you want to define yourself and your life in love. If you look at, you were playing the song Seasons of Love earlier in this show, and it says to measure your life in love, and this is such a good message for us to put forth in our community, that it's that we want to live in a way where we are appreciative of the people in it. And this whole situation has been an opportunity to spread this message.
You know, I'm going to add to this conversation Dan McMahon from the Goodspeed Opera House, where he's the marketing director. Whoops, what just happened? Something bad just happened. Well, I mean, I think I'm going to be, that was her. I'm going to add to the conversation Dan McMahon. We'll get Larissa back on the line in just a second. Dan McMahon is director of marketing at the Goodspeed Opera House. Now, one thing that's in East Haddam, I hope I don't have to tell people that, but maybe I do. Dan McMahon, one thing that you suggested, that your institution has suggested doing, is actually letting this particular group do the show there. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Michael Price made that offer yesterday. You know, we live and breathe musical theater here in the Opera House, and the staff have all been talking about it. And finally, Michael said yesterday, well, you know what? If the students want to do it, we want to encourage any young people to be involved in musical theater. So if they can't do it at their high school, they can come here and do it.
I mean, this story has gotten a certain amount of national attention, and Howard Sherman, who at one point for a number of years was general manager down at Goodspeed, has been blogging about it a lot. I mean, my sense is this isn't even just a Trumbull story anymore. It isn't just a Connecticut story. It kind of is one of these stories that the theater world is looking at and maybe thinking a little bit about high schools as an incubator for musical talent, for the kind of people who will be in musicals, and for the kind of people who, as audiences, will learn to appreciate musicals. True?
Oh, absolutely true. I mean, what's so encouraging to us these days is that musical theater is becoming cool again, that high school students are into musical theater. They go to musicals, they like musicals, they're singing the songs, and we haven't seen this in a generation or two, and so it's just a great thing. So anything we can do to encourage that, whether it's putting on the show or things like the high school musical awards and things like that, any of that kind of thing, all they do is encourage more and more young people to get involved.
How would you have been able to do this? I mean, the Goodspeed isn't dark that much. You've got a bunch of new play readings coming up in January, and then pretty soon after that, you're getting ready for your three-play season down there. How could you have put Rent on?
Well, what we kind of figured is that it was a spring play, and we opened the season April 11th. So if it could be done before then, we would load in the show at our show at the last minute and let Rent go on before that. If Rent wasn't ready by the time we had to start our performances, we had two options. One, do it at the Norma Terrace Theater in Chester, because that would be dark until May, or do it on the set of our show, we could, you know, and do it as a concert version. You know, somehow we'd make the show happen.
Larissa Marks, I think I knocked you off the line before, but you're back. So this is obviously a very generous offer by an incredibly prestigious regional theater. But I gather that it's sort of, you really do want to do this in Trumbull, right?
I have to say, we have been so honored to be contacted by Good Seat and other theaters around us. And it really says something about the theater community and how strong we are together and how important Brent is to so many of us. However, as the Trumbull High Theater Department, our first commitment does have to be to our own school, since we are still trying to build our program.
And you know what? I think all of us, even all of the theaters in the theater community, would encourage that. That's where the show belongs, is at your school, at the high school, for the local community to do it. And so we hope that's what will happen, but we want to make sure the show goes on no matter what.
All right. Well, at least maybe Larissa can get a couple of tickets to Damn Yankees or something out of this.
I'm sure we can arrange that. Maybe a job.
Yeah.
Sound very well poised.
All right. Listen, Dan McMahon, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And
thanks for talking about theater, Colin.
All right. Well, as you know, it's sort of in my blood. Also, a part of this conversation is Howard Sherman. I just mentioned him before. He's been head of the American Theater Wing most recently, but years ago he was general manager down at the Goodspeed, also director at the Eugene O'Neill. He's a big mocker in the world of theater. I can't list all of Howard's accomplishments in this amount of time. But you've also gotten really involved, Howard, in this. You've written, I think, at least three times on your much-read blog about theater. How did this become so important to you?
Well, I've written four times about Trumbull. The reason it's become important to me is because I keep finding out how often this happens around the country, and that this is not an issue that is unique to Trumbull. However, in communities, they always think it's just them. And what's important is that people who believe in the freedom of expression and of the value of letting students be challenged by challenging work, that they understand there's a larger world out there that wants to support them and wants to help them. And if indeed things go the way we're hearing they are in Trumbull, then we're proving that good, rational, reasonable conversation, superbly organized by the students themselves, can really make a difference.
Is there any sense in which also this particular dialogue is helpful? In other words, we don't want to have a situation where theater and artistic expression is quashed. On the other hand, the fact that there has sort of been a back and forth and a push and pull, and especially if there's this presumable good resolution to this, Howard, you know, it is a nice occasion anyway to talk about why theater is important. Why is it important to do one play instead of another?
Well, I think the idea of good open dialogue is great. I think ultimately, though, to get the results, this has also been a bit of brinksmanship. It had to become public. It had to become larger than just an issue within the school. The net result will be that conversation, but I think that conversation will ensue after, hopefully, the school recommits to allowing rent to go forward. Because it wasn't all open conversation. It was an edict that was handed down 2 weeks ago. It was reinforced last week at the Board of Education. There have been some unfortunate things said about a veteran teacher who was doing exactly what she has done in the past in relation to this show. But yes, theater is important, and theater can teach and learn. But, you know, not in the sense of now we're going to sit you down and teach you something, but in the sense that it can impart messages that are of value.
You know, one of the things I think you said in one of your more recent posts about this was that a few things, that you'd like to see a few things of this nature said in the course of working out the compromise, that some affirmation should be made of this teacher who, as you're saying, sort of followed the procedure she'd always followed, but then got treated as though she had done something wrong, that the principal, who, as Larissa says, is a really nice guy, but he's basically issued, I think, two statements now canceling this production, that if it's going to be reinstated, you'd kind of like to see something said. What would you like to see said?
I would like to see an acknowledgement of the teacher's commitment to the students, and I really think there needs to be an acknowledgement that it is the students who forced this dialogue open. I think that's what's important. This is not about the principal, the Board of Education, or the superintendent suddenly saying, well, we should think about this more. This is about students taking, you know, an absolute directive that the show was canceled and making it possible for the dialogue to happen. They are due the credit. The teacher, who professionally has to be quiet and uninvolved in these efforts, is due credit, as are, frankly, the parents in Trumbull. What's been so remarkable, and I've read pretty much every comment on every Facebook post imaginable, is there's nobody saying don't do Rent. That's only emanating from administration. And so fears of appropriateness or backlash are not coming from anywhere but the leadership, and the leadership had to be moved very respectfully by the students to a place where the conversation could happen.
Well, Howard German, thanks so much for calling in and for the role you played in all this. And Larissa Marks, I guess it's too early to congratulate you, but hopefully in the next 24 hours or so, you may get some good news, right?
I sure hope so.
All right. Larissa Marks from Trumbull High School, president of the Trumbull High School Thespian Society, thanks for being part of this conversation as well. We're going to do a quick pivot here. We can do these things on this show. Somehow or other, we're going to go from Rent to Owls. There may be some connection. Maybe even Patrick Comans knows what it is. He's the director of bird conservation for the Connecticut Audubon Society, our go-to guy in the bird world. So, Patrick, we've had sort of good news and bad news, right? The good news is that for whatever reason, and maybe you know a reason, the snowy owl is showing up around these parts in greater profusion than in the even recent past. So first of all, set that scene for us. I mean, how big a bounce back is the snowy owl having?
Sure, Colin. Yeah, we're getting unusually high numbers of snowy owls throughout the entire Northeast this winter. And these birds, they nest in the Arctic, and normally they can even overwinter up inside the Arctic Circle. But some years, and we don't know the exact reasons in each given year, but due to cycles in lemming populations and other prey like ptarmigan, combined with, especially when you have a decline in those prey base following a very successful nesting year, the snowy owls will come south in large numbers in search of food.
So we're seeing them in New York, we're seeing them in New England, you're seeing them here in Connecticut, right?
Yes, yeah, there have been several reports in Connecticut, including one that was sitting alongside Route 9 in Essex, right on a light post. And they've been seen as far south as North Carolina and even one on Bermuda, which is amazing.
So that's exciting news for birders, and we all know people who, or at least I know people, who are especially entranced by the snowy owl. It seemed like a very special bird, and people have a special relation to it. And, of course, it was also Harry Potter's bird as well. But the problem is that, or a problem has been, in New York, the Port Authority reacted with alarm. They're worried about bird strikes. They're probably more conscious of bird strikes than ever before, ever since 2009, the famous Sully Sullivan crash into the Hudson River seemed to involve a goose strike in some way. So their reaction to the snowy owl was to put out basically a death warrant on it, right?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, it's understandable that, you know, we obviously want to see people kept safe as well. But there are other ways to deal with it. Boston's Logan Airport has been successfully dealing with snowy owls for many years by trapping and relocating them to other open spaces that they can hunt safely. So Audubon had sort of put the Port Authority's feet to the fire, Audubon, New York, and they had sent letters to the Port Authority and sent out grassroots alerts to get people to contact them and express their displeasure about it. And we just learned that they're going to take alternate approaches. They're going to live trap the owls.
And just to sort of reemphasize what you just said, though, in Massachusetts, the Audubon Society kind of took the lead on this, right? They started a program of trapping and releasing the owls.
Yes, yeah. Massachusetts Audubon Society has been a great innovator in this approach, and we're glad that that their techniques are being exported to New York City. And, you know, that's one of the great things about working for a national conservation organization like this. Well, I can focus on issues in Connecticut. I have very capable colleagues in New York and partners in places like Massachusetts. And whenever we need help with issues, if I need to supply grassroots to them, I can get people to write letters. And likewise, if we have an issue in Connecticut, we can get people in other states to write letters.
One thing that I've heard or read, and I don't know how true this is, but that one of the reasons that some places like think the Port Authority or its equivalent in Massachusetts might get worried about this, is that the snowy owls look at these tarmacs. They look at these landing fields, and it looks enough like a tundra so that they're maybe kind of attracted to being there. True?
Exactly. They like wide open spaces. They're birds of the open tundra. So they tend to show up in places like airports or big farm fields, or especially along the coast with tidal marshes, places like Plum Island, Hammonasset Beach State Park are always attractive to snowy owls. And they'll even show up on islands, on offshore islands like Faulkner Island or Goose Island.
Good news, you get the compromise in New York. This seems to be a day for us to celebrate compromises. And bad news, of course, is that before you did that, a number of snowy owls met their death, right? The Port Authority had people out there with shotguns.
Yes, they did. You know, and that's really unfortunate. These birds do have a high mortality rate. They're generally young birds. And that's, you know, one reason we should give them space. If you see a snowy owl on the beach, don't try to approach it and take a picture with a cell phone, because that could also lead to mortality, because these birds are in a very tight energy budget. But enjoy them. And, yes, it was unfortunate that a few were killed, but I think, you know, if we have a good resolution and we're going to be keeping an eye on things to make sure that promises are met, you know, I think it's going to be a good news story overall.
What's the status of snowy owls overall? I mean, we've talked a little bit about the cycles that either bring them here or don't bring them here on a given year, but is it an endangered bird?
No, they're doing well as far as we know. They're a difficult bird to keep track of because they're found across the vast Arctic. They're circumpolar. That is, they're found all across the Northern Hemisphere and really in some amazingly remote areas. So it'd be very difficult to get you know, accurate information on population trends. But as far as we can tell, they're doing okay.
All right. Well, listen, Patrick Comins, Director of Bird Conservation for the Connecticut Audubon, for Connecticut at the National Audubon Society, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, thank you, Colin.
All right. We're going to keep moving here. We're going to take a little break. We're going to come back with kind of a related story, a story about our not-so-proud past in Connecticut when two towns along the Connecticut River were pretty much the center for the use of ivory on pianos.
On the snow, I've been waiting for you to come home. It's again that time of year, December 20.
If we can't do edgy musicals like Rent, what's left? Are we going to wind up with Carrie Underwood starring in Sound of Music on live TV or something? What's that? I'm sorry, apparently that's already happened. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Tay Diggs. For photos, links, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff performing Take Me or Leave Me from Rent, visit our great website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the benefits of singing with other people. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, just to quickly flesh that out for 2 seconds, all over Connecticut, first of all, we're in the heart of Handel's Messiah season, but people belong to choirs, I mean, church choirs and things like that, and chorales, choral groups, stuff like that, and there are a lot of benefits to that. You're going to hear stories tomorrow about how people get over tragedies in their lives or connect to communities in a way that they never have before, but you're also going to hear some cutting-edge neuroscience on this, too, on sort of what actually happens to people when they sing and when they sing with other people. So, and we hope you'll call in with your stories, too, stories about what singing with other people has done for you. Right now, we're continuing with our show that's sort of stitched together from a whole bunch of different topics. We thought it was kind of a nice segue, though, from snowy owls to elephants. So Richard Conniff, one of our favorite writers about nature and science, is the author of Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth. We came across an article he did in an online publication called Take Part about the past of two towns along the Connecticut River, down where Richard used to live. Welcome back to our show, Richard Conniff.
Hey, nice to be here, Colin.
So you were sort of sharing with your readers the stories of Deep River and Ivoryton. Ivoryton's past perhaps less of a mystery than Deep River's, but it was two big piano companies there that were using a lot of ivory during, what, the late 19th century, early 20th?
Yeah, that's right. So I moved to Deep River and I was traveling writing about wildlife, and then this story sort of came knocking at my door. The river landing below my house used to be an unloading point for ivory, and the factory at the other end of the street belonged to Pratt Reed and Company, which was one of the two piano keyboard companies that dominated the ivory trade in North and South America. The other one was Comstock Cheney in Ivoryton.
Now, I want to come back to them and tell a little bit of that history, but one of the reasons for writing about it and talking about it now is not simply because it's historically interesting, but because there is an ivory trade today. There's an ivory market today. It just doesn't happen to be where it used to be. It's in China now, right?
That's right, and it's a huge trade. And while the trade from the Connecticut River Valley was pretty destructive, this trade is leading to the extinction of elephants in the wild in Africa within the next 12 or 14 years. There are 35,000 elephants being killed every year. That's 96 a day. And some countries that are sort of the heart of elephant habitat, like Tanzania, are predicting that they will not have any more elephants before too long.
Do the Chinese want the ivory for the same things that we wanted it for 100 or more years ago, or do they do something else with it?
Well, no, we wanted it for music, for our piano keyboards. But it is the same. They want it for carvings, for knickknacks. But it is the same in the sense that both were about social status.
Mm-hmm.
For them, it's having the new money to be able to show that you can buy something as rare and expensive as ivory and have it beautifully carved. For us, it was being able to have the piano in the Victorian parlor, where it was kind of a symbol of having risen above the middling sort of folk. And, you know, the idea that your children, particularly your daughters, could play the piano and the family could gather around the piano sort of became a symbol of domestic happiness.
So let's talk a little bit about that history now then. As you say, it's sort of the story of an emergent class and what one of the real symbols of that emergent class was. Can you give us sort of a sense of the size of the operations in Deep River and Ivoryton?
Yeah, well, so that's what caught my eye the first time. I saw this postcard, an old postcard from early in the 20th century that showed a very early truck, more like a cart almost, and a bunch of tusks standing up in the back, and the caption was $9,000 worth of ivory in Deep River, Connecticut, or something like that. So they were hauling at that point. I think it was the ivory of 1,000 elephants were going to the factory at the end of my street to Pratt Reed, and this would have been around the turn of the century. The trade was about the same size over in Ivoryton. So thousands of elephants every year were being killed to supply the factories in those two towns. And I should say that Meriden also had an ivory business. Its business was more to do with dinnerware and ivory-handled knives and that sort of thing.
Was there any, I mean, we're sort of talking really kind of about a period of use of Ivoryton that ends pretty much kind of at the tail end of the abolition movement. And the abolition movement's kind of a nice example of a debate that was going on, a feverish debate that was going on in America. Was any comparable debate about elephants? Did anybody question whether this was a good thing to be doing?
No, not at all. I think the idea was that, in fact, there was an article published that I came across in my research that said that elephants are as numerous as flies in Africa. So the idea was that they were going to be, I mean, it was like suggesting that you could empty the seas of their fish. There was just an endless supply of elephants, so not to worry.
And one of the founders, the founder of one of these two businesses, the one in Deep River, he was an abolitionist, right?
Yeah, George Reed is a very interesting character because in the 1830s, when it was very risky to be an abolitionist in Connecticut, he was actively fighting against slavery, and his house in Deep River was a station on the Underground Railroad. And in fact, a well-known Deep River character in the later 19th century came to the town via the Underground Railroad in the 1850s, and he took up the name Billy Winter. There's still a street in town named Winter Avenue, I think. Lots of very idealistic work against slavery on George Reed's part.
But not so much for the elephants. Bad news for them. And you know, this is maybe not incidental. You probably saw the same article I did today in the Science Times, where philosophers and animal rights activists are also sort of talking about how to evaluate the rights of animals and whether animals can have rights that amount to personal rights. That
yeah.
I mean, an elephant can recognize his or her reflection in the mirror, things like that.
Yeah, but that would have been completely alien in the 19th century. Nobody would have even given that a moment's thought. But the other irony about George Reed is that his business depended on Arab caravans that would leave from Zanzibar and go deep into the countryside to gather the ivory. And those caravans generally proceeded by violent raids on villages, killing the women and the children, and seizing the men and some of the women to carry the tusks back down to the coast. And we supplied the gunpowder and the weapons for that. And yet somehow managed to keep that off of the moral register. and it's possible because Africa was a very long way away from the Connecticut River Valley at that point, that people didn't know. On the other hand, traders from Deep River and Ivoryton went to Zanzibar and they managed the business. And it's hard to believe that they didn't communicate about some of the problems and some of the other unsavory aspects of the trade that they were witnessing.
Well, you know, Richard Conniff, let's sort of bring this back to the present moment then. I mean, obviously, we have very different attitudes as a nation right now about elephants and about how animals teetering on the brink of extinction ought to be treated. Different attitudes than we did in 1860 or 1920. But is there anything from that? Meanwhile, China doesn't necessarily share those attitudes. So is there anything from that distant Connecticut past that can instruct the present Chinese moment?
Yeah. Well, so the first thing, first, I think the Chinese are changing their moral values and their environmental ideas pretty quickly. I mean, if only as a matter of survival, you know, just being able to breathe in their cities, they need to realize that taking care of the environment matters. And so their values are changing quickly, and there are people who are working to change their values towards animals as well. And so I think that'll happen. But what they need to know from the Connecticut River Valley is that our role in killing thousands and thousands and thousands of elephants and eliminating them from large parts of Africa at that time is a permanent mark of shame for us. And it will be an even larger mark of shame for China if it doesn't merely allow the killing of 35,000 elephants a year or encourage it or pay for it, but if it causes the extinction of the species, if it causes one of the most beloved land animals on Earth to vanish from the wild forever, that will be a lasting disgrace. And on the other hand, if they see the opportunity to save elephants, then they'll be able to get that one thing that great nations all seek, which is the admiration of the world. So status, which has been the demise of the elephant, could in the end become its salvation.
All right. We can only hope. Richard Conniff, so great to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you too, Colin.
All right. Take care. That's Richard Conniff. He is a writer about science and wildlife, author of Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth. Let us know how you like these shows. We'll, in the middle of the week, by the way, you're hearing Paul Winter's song derived from the calls of elephants, a Paul Winter composition that we're ending with called, appropriately enough, The Call of the Elephant. So while you're hearing the elephants, let me quickly also mention, communicate with us at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. One thing we are doing is shifting a little bit. Not every day. In the middle of the week, we usually do kind of one-hour shows that focus intently on one idea. That's what we'll be doing tomorrow and on Thursday. But at the beginning of the week and the end of the week, maybe a little bit more of a deadline orientation. Let us know how you like or don't like what we're doing. Thanks to everybody who helped out today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
I'm Kyone Wolf, officially offering my apartment for the young thespians in Trumbull to perform Rent without the fear of... Sorry. Thespians.